Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Tom Riley to the broadcast. Tom is the Chief Executive Officer of Cloudera, a fast-growing software company that provides Apache Hadoop-based software support and service and training to businesses. Tom has been the CEO since July of 2013. Prior to Cloudera, Tom served as the CEO of ArcSight, an enterprise security company. Tom led the initial public offering of ArcSight and led the company in the subsequent sale to HP. He also served as the CEO of Trigo Technologies, a master data management software company, which was later acquired by IBM. Tom serves on multiple boards, including Jive Software, Ombud Incorporated, ThreatStream, and Cloudera. Tom received his Bachelor of Science degree in Mechanical Engineering from the University of California at Berkeley. I recently caught up with Tom in his office in Palo Alto, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 1, People, as we discussed how his organization builds and retains talented individuals. Principle 4, IT and Business Partnerships, as we discussed the organization's current priorities and how the organization is continuing to pivot in a fast-changing industry. We also discussed how he views the path to success for older organizations as well as those from the Web 2.0 era, the relationships that Cloudera has built with online education providers, and some industry-specific use cases for Cloudera's services, as well as a variety of other topics. This is Peter High. Please consider reading my new book, Implementing World-Class IT Strategy, How IT Can Drive Organizational Innovation. The book covers topics such as the CIO as strategic facilitator, the development of IT missions, facilitating corporate and divisional strategy, the development of IT's own strategic plans, the development of enterprise architecture, reviewing, refreshing, and communicating strategy, and several other topics, all told with stories from leading CIOs from a variety of major corporations. You can find it at Amazon.com, my publisher's website, Wiley.com, and at your better bookstores. Thank you very much.
So Tom, I thought we'd begin with your company, Cloudera. It's an organization that allows others, other enterprises, to store, process, and analyze all their data in one place. Certainly a challenge that a lot of organizations have had in recent years, especially as they grapple with the topic of big data and analytics and turning this mountain of information that is collected into greater insights. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where the company stands now, its current iteration and evolution, as well as perhaps a bit from your current priorities and strategic plan, the extent to which you can share.
Well, so let's just talk about the initial value proposition. Traditionally, enterprises have always had a lot of data to grapple with, and they like to have it all in one place, but it's become exacerbated in the recent years because as the world's become interconnected, there's a whole new set of data in volume and complexity of data that enterprises haven't seen before. So our value proposition is to help enterprises and corporations capitalize on all this new data that's coming from the connected world. And if they can get this new data, they're going to have better understanding of their customers and will be able to service them better. They will be able to introduce new data-driven products based on the data. They can introduce new products and services. And increasingly, we're seeing that they're going to leverage this platform such as ourselves in gathering more data to mitigate risk and address regulatory pressures. So I guess the theme of that statement there is our value proposition is to help enterprises transition and transform to this new interconnected world, which is very different in the last 10 to 15 years. And that's why technology such as ours is of great interest to these enterprises. Now, what's different today is enterprises now understand the use cases they need to work on to maintain a competitive advantage in this connected world. And we're seeing those high-value business applications come to market at a feverish pace. And that's what's exciting, because 2 years ago, I think people were still trying to understand, what does this connected world mean? How is it going to affect my industry? What are the technologies I have available to me? And we've seen a fast shift in the last 2 years to industries really transforming.
I can't help but thinking, Tom, as you say that, that the path towards developing and combining all of one's data in a single place, a single repository, so that you know the data can talk together and create a richer experience, is going to be much more complex for an organization that is of an older vintage, that has cobbled together an infrastructure and has been gathering data for years in an environment where they were not anticipating the need for the combination of that data in ways that certainly have emerged as sources of potential competitive advantage and certainly sources of insight that are of great importance to almost any company, versus those organizations, digital native organizations, for instance, or those created in a more recent times where that complexity isn't quite the same. Having collaborated with companies in both of those buckets, if you buy into the dichotomy that I've just sorted out there, can you talk a little bit about the path towards success for one versus the other?
I'll frame it this way. There are the what traditionally were called the Web 2.0 companies, right? You know, the new modern companies like a Google, a Yahoo, a LinkedIn, a Facebook. And these enterprises gathering data and using data to their competitive advantage and as a core part of the services is why they are so successful. And I think a lot of what we're doing in this market that we call big data, or we like to think of ourselves as delivering the modern data management analytics platform, is to help traditional enterprises become more like those modern enterprises. And so the challenge traditional enterprises have is they have all these silos of systems. When they were doing automation, you know, 15, 20 years ago, it was all very process-centric, application-centric. And today we're helping them become more data-centric and more information-driven than process-driven. And that's our role in this, is I have to say, we're helping traditional enterprises transition and look more like Google. And if we can help them do that, whether it's an insurance company, a retailer, a large bank, a telecommunication company, or a healthcare provider, if we can make them operate more like a Google or a Yahoo or a Facebook, they're going to be just servicing their customers much better. They're going to have more competitive products and services. There's just tremendous advantages.
What are some of the industries that you're particularly focused on now?
I'll share with you our most prevalent industries have been financial services, the telecommunications industry, and the public sector. And that's no surprise. Each of these industries have large, large amounts of data. They have multiple products and services. They're highly fragmented. And so you could see them gravitating to this modern data management platform. What's exciting, though, is the acceleration of emerging industries. We're seeing healthcare invest significantly. And for the first time in my career, I truly believe that a technology platform can transform an industry. And healthcare is one of those industries that's going through transformation around the electronic medical record. And with electronic medical record comes a whole bunch of information about patients, which leads to population health and genomic research, patient recovery, sending patients home instead of keeping them in the hospital. I mean, a lot of things happening in healthcare. The next industry we're seeing great use cases is manufacturing. And a lot of times when we talk about the Internet of Things, it's a very broad category, but in manufacturing, a very simple use case is phone home. And whether you make tractors, you make cars, you make computers, you make software, increasingly we're seeing all those devices get censored, send information back to the manufacturer so that they in turn can offer better service, they can offer better support, they can design better products. And that whole manufacturing industry is really exciting. And then the third one I'm going to call on, which is a personal favorite of mine, is the insurance industry. The insurance industry hasn't seen much change over the years. You know, there's been all these actuaries, and you're always trying to, they focus so much on understanding their risk. But I think the insurance industry is going to move quickly to what we're calling usage-based insurance. So think of automobiles. We'll move to pay-as-you-drive insurance or pay-how-you-drive insurance. Home insurance will change as the insurance providers are able to monitor homes and understand whether you have an alarm system that you actually do turn on. Do you lock your doors? you have a functioning sprinkler system? Can they take satellite images of your rooftops and understand, you know, fire hazards? So long answer, I guess, Peter, you know, financial services, telecom, public sector is where we've made our great success. But we're seeing industries like healthcare, manufacturing, insurance really step up with some very exciting use cases.
Clearly, your organization has clearly developed a leadership position in the space, but it's a space, obviously, that's attracting a lot of attention, a lot of venture capital, and a lot of very smart minds and companies entering into the space. What do you see as your source of competitive advantage relative to other usual suspects? One might add to the list is the competitive set.
One of the reasons we're recognized as the leader is that we're consistently the innovator in this category. And in driving innovation, we're not just, you know, doing it for our own sake. We're doing it for the industry. And the faster we can grow this industry and help, you know, all these different corporations transform their businesses, I think it's great for our business, but great for the overall ecosystem. And so we have today, one of our competitive advantages is we have the largest ecosystem of partners who are developing solutions and adding value to our platform. And that ecosystem of partners is following us because of our innovation. And where we focus our attention is on the largest enterprises. And for the largest enterprises, we deliver a modern, you know, data management analytics platform that we consider to be the fastest, the easiest platform to deploy, and the most secure. And the large enterprises are focused on, you know, fastest goes to their total cost of ownership. Easiest is they want to have the fewest amount of resources of running these applications in production. And the most secure is a core differentiator for us. So that, those become our enduring differentiators and having that large ecosystem of partners.
You've been with the company now for 2.5 years, roughly. How did they find you? How did you find them? What was the logic of the union in the early stages?
So this is my third time that I've been hired in as a CEO to fast-growing companies with very strong technical founders. And I'm not technical at my roots. My value and my skill set is in scaling businesses, keeping organizations aligned, and building high-performing operations. And so I was contacted by some of the board members at Cloudera. I was not actively considering new roles. I was actually semi-retired at the time. But when I was contacted by Cloudera and this opportunity arose, it took me about 5 minutes to decide that this was the job I wanted. And it goes back to my time at HP. We were in these strategy sections about, you know, where the growth in the future was going to be. Hadoop and Cloudera kept showing up on whiteboards. So I was very familiar from our HP discussions and strategy plannings that this was a tremendous category to be part of. I then spent time with the founders, in particular, Mike Olson and Amar Awadalla and Jeff Hammerbacher. And, you know, the company is their company. Startups, especially high-growth startups, the soul of the company goes back to the founders. And my role is not to take over the company, but to make their company better. So I had to have a very good relationship with those founders. And it's something I'm very proud of having achieved here. This company is still that of Mike Olson, Amar Awadalla, and Jeff Hammerbacher. And my role is just to make sure it runs well and it's growing at a pace that everyone's proud of.
You mentioned, Tom, this is the third time you've been hired in as a CEO. And obviously, there are volumes of examples of companies where the hired in CEO and the founders don't mesh well. One thinks of John Sculley and Steve Jobs after they came together, for instance, is one of perhaps one of the more prominent examples of that. Obviously, this is something now you've got a good deal of experience with. What are some of the lessons that you have learned now across multiple experiences in forging a productive relationship CEO to founders?
I think a lot of CEOs get caught up in the title and think that by being CEO, you have to put your print, it's your company. And I think a lot of failed transitions have come down to CEOs coming in wanting to put their print on a company. I view the CEO job as just one of the many jobs in a company. You know, we have over 1,000 employees. Everyone puts in their 10 to 12 hours a day, as do I. my job is just the unique one, but it's one to enable and make all those 1,000 employees much more efficient. So I focus on things, you know, do we have the right strategy? Is it well communicated? Do we measure it well? Do we have the right team in place? But all through it, I recognize that I joined a company when it was 6 years old and in a high growth company. And those first 6 years were led by the great founders with great innovation, great vision. And I respect that and I want to endure that. So this is where little things like, you know, Mike Olson was our founding CEO, and today he's our chairman and chief strategy officer. But for our first year, we sat right next to each other on a bench in a very open place in the company to send a message that, you know, we were a team. And today we operate very well as a team.
You and Mike Olson have mentioned that the organization's in no rush to go public. You've obviously grown dramatically across the 8+ years that the organization has been in existence and continue to in the 2.5 years that you've been at the helm. You have in the past, ArcSight Prep being the most recent example, successfully led companies through to the initial public offering. I wonder, what are some of the things that are influencing your thought process and the other leaders of the company in contemplating how long to remain private versus the advantages of tapping the public markets?
Yes, so thank you for knowing my past, Peter. I learned a lot about taking ArcSight public, and I will share with you it was a great experience and great learnings about what it means to be a public company and how you need to respect the shareholders that you brought into the fold. We fully intend to be a public company, and that is the path we are on. However, we have a tremendously strong financial position. And so that gives us flexibility to do it on our timing. And what influences our thinking right now, if you look at the markets, I believe that investors are looking for the following things. They're looking for big markets with leaders that are demonstrating high growth in those big markets. But they're increasingly looking for, they want to see it, these companies at a scale so that there is a proven model that gives, with great predictability, a path to profitability. Investors are looking for a clear path to profitability with a proven business model. That proven business model can only happen if you have scale and history there. And, of course, they're looking for the high growth. So those are things we're working on. And when we think we have that well understood and demonstrated, I think it has us positioned for a tremendous entry into the public markets. I think we'd be a great public company today. We've got a lot of the metrics that most companies feel they could go. But I often say, not only do you want to be a great enterprise software company, we want to be one of the best run enterprise software companies. And to do that, you need a lot of data and scale.
One of the things I always find so intriguing for companies like yours is naturally one of the key ingredients is not watering down the talent as the organization gets larger. You mentioned that yours is an organization that has reached quadruple digits. You're in the thousands now of people. You operate in a space and a geography that is hyper competitive in terms of hiring and retaining great talent. Can you talk a little bit about the methods used to build a team? Something, as you mentioned before, that's one of the areas that you've got some depth of experience and presumably one of the reasons why you were such an attractive CEO when you were hired in. What are the methods that you use in building teams, but also very importantly, retaining great teams?
Thank you. That's a very, very important topic and probably worth the whole interview in and of itself. So first off, we have a team in place. And I think a team that is well aligned, that communicates very efficiently, that everyone is kind of heading in the same direction, can be 30 to 50% more efficient than a competitor. And so I spend a lot of time on alignment. It's very important that we have a clear, well thought out long-term strategy. And I work with the leadership team on that. But once you have that and you revisit it regularly, you then have to communicate that consistently to the whole company. And you have to make sure that everyone is putting their efforts behind those key elements that will deliver on that strategy. So We learned from Google this whole notion of having a few set of key objectives and the key results behind that and aligning everyone to chase after that. With alignment, then, you can give autonomy to your teams to make decisions. And so suddenly people start enjoying their jobs more because they know that they can make decisions that are in alignment with where the company wants to go instead of always trying to guess what the priorities are. So that's tremendously important. The next thing is hiring talent that matches to the culture you want to have. I brought on two new executives this year that reflect that. Hires that will change, well, will reinforce how our company operates, but also will bring some new insights as far as scale. So I brought on a gentleman named Vishal Rao, who ran worldwide sales at Splunk. He now runs our worldwide field operations, and he has roughly a third of our company. And I also recently hired a gentleman named Dan Sturman, who was a vice president out of Google. And he ran the whole Google Compute and Google App Engine market. And he runs our engineering organizations, another third of our company. And where I spent most of my time interviewing them wasn't on their skills as a salesman or as a lead of an engineering team. It was their culture aspects of what it means to be a leader and how they got to their points in their career. And they reinforced the whole notion of, you know, alignment, communication, transparency, continually challenging and making sure that people are performing at their best. And that's what we need to do. We want our field team to be extremely competitive. We want our engineering organization to be extremely innovative and have a lot of initiative. And those two kind of reflect those.
You talked in multiple parts of our conversation about the role you play naturally in setting strategy for the organization. And I'd be curious about how you think about strategic planning in an organization that is growing so rapidly and has had, understandably, a variety of pivots in its model as time has gone on. Now, naturally, of course, the business model is now successful enough that those pivots probably are not going to be coming quite as fast or as furiously. But how do you think about the process of setting strategy and then amending and revising it based on the realities of the markets that you're pursuing and the ideas that you're putting out there?
Well, I would challenge one thing you said, Peter. I find this market that we're in continually evolving. And we can't sit on our laurels and say, oh, we're the leader and everything's going in our direction and we have the best strategy. We continually revisit our strategy. It's not my role to determine our strategy. It's not my role to be the strategist for the company. My role is to make sure we have a strategy and to lean on the really smart founders and technical leaders and business leaders we have to get the best ideas from them, to boil it down to a strategy, and then to make sure we're executing on it. A lot of CEOs think it's their job to come up with a strategy. I am by far not the most skilled to do that. Not when I have, you know, Mike Olson and Jeff Hammerbacher and Amar Awardala and Dan Sturman and Vishal Rao, Charles Zalewski. So regularly our team comes together and in a bit of paranoia, we're like, you know, okay, where's the market going? What are some of the new projects that are emerging? What are our customers asking for? Which customer markets we want to go after, which verticals, which partners. And I think one of our strengths is we're not wedded to what made us successful in the past. We're very focused on what will be making us successful in the future. It's that nimbleness. Even as we cross through 1,000 people, I want to be that nimble when we're 5,000 and 10,000 people. And that is, I think, going to be the hallmark of our long-term success. And my job is just to foster that kind of continual innovation and initiative in this team, and then getting aligned behind the areas we think are most important.
You and your team have developed some really interesting ways to get the word out about Cloudera, as well as to facilitate people's use of the products that you have. You've talked about an emphasis on teaching developers how to design and build big data applications. You've actually partnered with Udacity, I was interested to see, in a intro to Hadoop and MapReduce course. Can you talk a little bit about your partnership with the so-called MOOCs, the massive open online courses, in order to educate not only existing but also potential customers of your company?
Yeah, Peter. So no surprise, there's a huge demand for skills in the data management analytics space. And we believe it is on us to close that gap. So we invest significantly in education. you talked about one of four ways we do it, which is partnering with firms like Udacity doing massive open online courses. That's been incredibly successful. Udacity is now focused on developing a nano degree around big data and Hadoop for their students. Courses like Udacity are great for bringing new people into this industry, helping them transition from one area of expertise in IT into this area and giving them that, you know, baseline training that often they can do at their current job or they can do it at home or augmenting their other training. So we've been very, very pleased with Sebastian's team and their understanding about what's effective in that training mechanism. And we've done tens of thousands of people through the MOOCs. We also have a large public training program where across the globe, Cloudera and our partners in hotel rooms in every major city have public training events that people can sign up for, and they spend 4 or 5 days going through kind of hands-on training. We have a private training program where our customers might want to bring in several dozen of their employees and get them trained on their unique needs. And then what I'm most excited about is we have what's called the Cloudera Academic Program. And today we have more than 60 universities that have taken our curriculum and it's introducing it into their computer science programs. And so now we have, you know, the next generation of computer scientists coming out of university getting trained on this modern platform. And I believe we've trained well over 50,000 people around the globe as they come into this big data market.
Is there anything that I've not asked you that you think would be particularly interesting, anything that perhaps eluded my research in preparation for the conversation that you want to cover?
We could spend more time on the actual industry-specific use cases. We're seeing a lot of consistency in those use cases. It's what we find our customers are most interested in hearing. What are the most impactful use cases? I call them boardroom-level use cases. A use case that the boardroom of a large insurer or a large retailer or a large telco would talk about how data is transforming their industry. And love to, you know, walk you through those.
Do you have time for maybe one example?
Sure. The telecommunications industry. Their number one area of use of this technology is around reducing customer churn. And they're trying to identify proactively customers that will become unhappy and therefore may leave their service. This is particularly having great success internationally, where their customers are not on contracts. They are on prepaid cards, and they're focused on, you know, keeping those customers. So we see that use case throughout the telco industry. In insurance, I talked about usage-based insurance. Find those very, very interesting. But in healthcare, we have some great – one of the use cases I'm most proud of is what we did with Cerner. So Cerner is the largest provider of electronic medical records. And they took our software, and for those hospitals that use their electronic medical record system, they built a monitoring application where they can monitor patients in hospitals. Turns out that every year, 260,000 people in the U.S. die from what's called sepsis, a toxic reaction to infections in the hospital. In a limited pilot, in a limited part of the country, Cerner this past year, using our software, is able to proactively alert hospitals to patients susceptible to sepsis and have saved nearly 3,000 lives. That is impactful. And then I'll go into one other area, in financial services. Financial services firms in the boardroom, they are always talking about regulatory pressures and the fines that they're receiving. And it's turning out that our platform, our modern data management platform, is becoming used in every financial service firms to address regulatory pressures, whether it's anti-money laundering, KYC, which stands for Know Your Customer, BCDS or CCAR, which are about risk aggregation. Great, great use cases in financial services that are being discussed in the boardroom.
Very good examples. I really appreciate you quickly running through those. Certainly bring some of what you're doing to further light. I appreciate those, Tom.
Oh, we haven't even talked about what our customers are doing in cybersecurity or in the public sector around counterterrorism and protecting citizens. These are the exciting things. Rather than talking about the technology, we're talking about how it's really helping business.
Yeah, the value your customers are getting out of using it. It's great. That makes a lot of sense. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate your time this morning.
All right, Peter. Thank you for the time.
You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Arman. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.